come here to translate? Maybe she comes if somebody wants to speak in German, she can translate for us. Do you want me to answer? I forgot to answer your question. I don't know if Jorge fully answered your question about... Yeah?
Okay. Okay, so the other question will be, what way did people start during this whole process to supersede, to transgress commodity production? Meaning that what way did they organize, reorganize their social life, the reproduction beyond forms of money, commodity?
Should I start? Okay.
Yeah.
So it varied from place to place. In more than one place, this moment in which the state intervened or nationalized and recognized the situation, it imposed its own rules. But in some situations, that was not the case. Obviously, we can discuss what it means to supersede the commodity form. But the fact that people detach productivity from income and exchange things without the mediation of money and the law of value, so that we know exactly how much this is worth, and so you have to pay for it. In a lot of places that happened, in the sense, or it was planned to happen, since that people got together and decided how should we make this work. The fact that the process was so fast in some cases blocked that, and then eventually the police came back and actually took the factories out. But I was able to, in archives and so forth, find some documents. And there was such things like the metal workers went on strike and announced to the government that they would directly negotiate with the occupied land committees. So there was this massive units of production that were created in the south, which were occupied by the workers, and then the state recognized it and made a legal dispatch, and they were like, okay, so you're blocking the credit to them, so we'll just go directly to them and exchange. We'll give them our product, the metal, so that they can plow the fields and whatnot, and we'll discuss with them the ways that they will, you know, pay us back. We can always discuss, so if there's a payback, it's commodity. But there's this process of trying to get around it. And you have other moments like this in which construction firms that are intervened, there was in Sacavém, a little bit north of Lisbon, which ended in early 76 with armed cars going in and taking the construction workers out of the company. But they did a huge project along with tenants and neighbors committees. So we'll help you build new houses or, you know, reinstall the houses, and we'll see how we'll... But at the same time, and I think your question goes to the heart of the problem, obviously the bank system always played a very decisive role. The bank workers' union, which was totally controlled by the Communist Party until the end of August of 75, had a major role in this. And what they did was serve as middleman between the state and any workers' committee in a self-managed company. And then they would go to the labor ministry and negotiate, a credential would be given, and they could basically use the money of the company in the bank or open a new account and get credit from the state. So there was this negotiation process. And once the channel of negotiation is open, for most workers, it's a very pragmatic decision to get the wages, ensure that I have the money to, you know, pay my rent, put food on the table, and so forth. And it's this process that it makes it so problematic to fully understand how far did the process go. But what I did find was a will to go beyond the commodity relation. How far did people actually go is another discussion, which we can have, obviously. But it's the time here is the key element, because there's a moment in which people have things and they have the upper hand, and there's the moment there in which they've just lost it. And I don't know.
I agree essentially with what has been said by Ricardo. I think it was a process. I mean, but it was in terms of abolishing the wage system or abolishing the value relation, then we didn't got there. I mean, it was that takes more than 1 year. I mean, it's. I think that what's important here is to see this aspect that Ricardo just underlined. I mean, the will of people. I mean, people was looking for society organized in a different way. They didn't want to go back to the old way. The project that was offered to them as a solution was the state socialism, basically. And that they also realized very fast it was an authoritarian project. And that's an element very strong in this 1 year of the Portuguese social agitation or revolution, whatever we want to, the way we want to call it, is the fact that the Communist Party played an enormous role in that in this movement was never able completely to go behind this defiance that people had towards their authoritarian way. And that, I think, I've been thinking quite a lot about that. I think there are reasons in the Portuguese history and culture who explains that, in a way, because Portugal is a country where the authoritarian system has been strong from the beginning of its when it was built in the 12th century, because it was built by the military orders. But there is also a country where there is a very strong libertarian feeling for in the minds of people, sometimes in a very passive way. But it's not a society who is really very attracted to authoritarian tendencies and authoritarian projects. Actually, even Salazar used to say that Nazism and fascism were too strong for the Portuguese culture, because he felt himself that didn't fit in the Portuguese way of functioning. I'm not doing any nationalistic speech about the Portuguese culture, but I mean the fact is that the protection against the Communist Party appeared very, very early in the Portuguese Revolution. I mean, although the Portuguese militants were very present, they had paid a big tribute during the fascist period, and they were very active. But right away after the revolution, when they start to intervene in a party way, in an authoritarian way, they provoked a reaction. And actually, Ricardo also told that very fast minutes ago, the Socialist Party and the right used that in a way, because people really get, there was a point, this summer of 75, that also brings us to that question, the moment when things turned. I mean, this summer was also a period where the communists start to be attacked, not always in a good way, and not always in the good for the good reasons, but start to be attacked directly by people, because they were in some situations they were seen as new authoritarian people coming in. Well, I'm going out of your question, but what I want to say in a way is that, well, I think Ricardo already said that what was important here was that there was a desire of building something new. People didn't have enough time to do it, first of all because of the question of time, but also for the question of space. Portugal is a very poor society, very isolated. It was necessary at least to have some connection with Spain. That didn't happen. And the rest of Europe was just looking, I mean, or going there doing revolutionary tourism. I mean, a lot of people went there and helped a lot and get engaged in struggles and strikes and so forth. But that was not the same thing that creating the conditions to spread the movement elsewhere. So there was not really time to raise these questions of creating a society where products were produced and dominated and distributed in a different way without going through the market. I mean, the market has been always there. It's too long, but I mean, that's...
Well, everyone in Europe except for Guy Debord, who refused to go when he was invited by Afonso
Montet.
Well, he
had something to do.
Yeah.
I don't see things like that. I understand what you mean, but I don't think it's very useful for our minds if we are against this society to think in those terms, because that's what happens after. But when things are happening, I mean, you don't know. I mean, it's open. So
you think that will happen now?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what will happen tomorrow. I mean, societies are very difficult to analyze in terms of moment, because you can be living in a society where nothing happens, and tomorrow you have a general strike and people are looking for another way of life and things like that. So it's the fact that that never happened doesn't mean for me that will not happen.
Okay. No,
so.
Revolution, that's what.
Yeah.
It always happened, but it ends up that way. It's
okay.
True. Till now, we have all the people who want to change the world have been defeated.
Yes.
But we are still here.
Yeah.
And other people will come.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this society is not, I mean, it's sick. I mean, we cannot live on this stuff. So we live, but we don't live well.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who think that even don't, they don't do anything, but they also agree with us. But I mean, that's it's true. So far, we have been defeated. But that's not a reason to start again tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, I think.
If I can add something to what George just said. So I think people live better in Portugal now than they did before, the 25th of April. I strongly believe that. In terms, well, like, for instance, there's usually when... moderate left-wing people, so going as far as left bloc, which is equivalent to D-Link here, and to the Socialist Party, if we could still call them left-wing, I don't know. So this institutional left, let's call it like this, whenever somebody asks like that or actually says, which there's still a lot of people who will say that in Portugal, oh, well, but we were better off before the 25th of April because, you know, the coin was strong. We had our own coin, which right now, as you can imagine, is a very strong imaginary thing. But, you know, the coin was we'd go shopping and with one escudo we would bring back so many things. That's a very common phrase. But whenever that is said, people will just, you know, open the book of statistics. So it's like Portugal is one of the countries where more children would die. And I'm not saying dying at labor, which would also happen, but dying in the first year of their lives because they didn't have enough to eat. Actually, when you look at pictures of Portugal, films, you see that people don't have enough to eat. On the 25th of April, the faces of people, I mean, they don't look like we do, which we do three meals a day. You know, we can have at least all the nutrients that we need. Maybe not enough vitamins, I don't know, and the food probably is not, you know, it has too many pesticides, whatnot. But, you know, you have the calories, the minimum calories to, and that was not the case for the majority of the Portuguese population at all before the 25th of April, and it became the case. You know, enough to eat, enough, your children, the evolution in child mortality is just, it's one of the countries where less children die right now. Which, for me, for instance, I'm going to be a father in some months. I think that's quite important. But there's a lot of other, you know, indicators like alphabetization, people who know how to read and whatnot. It's still a very backward, poor country, unequal. That, but was it worth it? Yeah, I think it was worth it in more than one way. And at the same time, I would just rephrasing your question or... I don't know, changing it a little bit. I think there are cycles. So people mobilize, struggle, win things. They're on the brink of winning, then they lose. There's a capitalist restructuring. Things change. The shape of things change. You have to learn how to struggle in this new scenario. And I think we're still learning how to struggle in post-Fordism, neoliberal, restructured capitalism. We're living the first serious crisis of that flexible accumulation regime, which was created in the end of the 70s, early 80s, and then spread throughout the world. We're still learning how to do it. And so it's very likely that we'll be more defeated than we win for a long time. I mean, it's not by chance that they're the ruling class. They have a lot of instruments, a lot of strength, a lot of resources. They're not stupid, unlike what we sometimes like to think. And so they'll be around, and we'll be around, and we'll see. But so there are cycles. It's not as simple as revolutions that always are defeated and we end worse. You mean the 3 years with Allende Unidad Popular government? I don't think that was a revolution. It was an electoral win by left-wing coalition. So yeah, but it's not a revolution. There was a referendum in Chile, right? I don't want to downplay the social struggle in Chile.
It was a referendum, but the people died in the street anyway.
I'm quite sure that a lot of people struggled quite a lot in Chile. Yeah. It's not that. It's just that. Sure, but I agree with you. Usually the classical explanation is that there were seven big economic groups, which were called the Magnificent Seven, who owned the country in the sense that they owned most of the big strategic companies of the production of steel, paper, electricity, tobacco, the banks, most of the metal works, a lot of multinationals were joint ventures, whatnot. And I think all of them had to flee the country, especially after March 11, when there was an attempted coup. They were defeated, and their companies were nationalized, and they started being arrested. First of all, they were liberated, so they were taken out of prison because the international bourgeoisie and establishment intervened. So the World Bank, for instance, imposed, they were negotiating a loan, and they said, okay, we'll, in order for the negotiation to continue, you have to take the Espírito Santo family out of jail. That's the first thing. And they were backed by big business. They were, especially the Espírito Santo family, were very connected with the Rothschilds and, you know, a lot of Rockefeller, a lot of big people. And they went abroad to Brazil, especially the international circuit, Luxembourg, they had, which was an offshore already, Swiss, London, Madrid, and throughout all that, they had put a lot of money out of the country, a lot of money. I mean, not as much as they lost, obviously, but thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. So they used that money. They had credit lines from big banks internationally, and they rebuilt their fortune, especially in South America, Brazil, Paraguay, where there were dictatorships, basically, who were eager to attract foreign capitalists and all that. And when, then using that money, they started buying companies in Portugal from the late 70s and early 80s, so before the privatization process actually began. And then when it began, and it was mostly after 89, the constitution was changed, because originally the constitution, which was approved in 76, said that the nationalizations were irreversible. You could not give that back to their owners. In 89, it was changed, allegedly because the European Communion imposed it, but that's not even true. But it was in this pro-market Maastricht European Union integration process that it was explained that no, but European Union is about market economy. We have distortions of the market because the state owns this and that. And so after 89, these old families who were owners of the country came back, got money back in indemnization, you say that? Indemnization from the state, and with that money bought back their companies. And in some cases, it was an open offer, a public offer. Whoever bid bigger would get the companies. But in some cases, the government actually refused offers by Spanish banks or German banks or French banks and sold them back to these countries, to these companies, to keep the strategical decision in Portugal. And what most of these families' interests did was, in the late 90s, sell them away, very highly valued. In the meantime, because the Portuguese economy grew a lot in the 90s, in relative terms, obviously. And so they sold these companies that they bought with money that the state had given them, very cheap, preferentially in a lot of times, but without any kind of condition. And then they sold it back to the biggest offer, made huge amounts of money, and then invested in non-concurrential sectors. So land estate, real estate, health systems, private health, a lot of services that are not competitive, electricity company, which has a monopoly but is private, which is now bought by the state, Chinese state electricity company. So these families rebuilt their fortunes abroad, enhanced them by buying off their former companies, and then multiplied it by 10 by selling it back to international lenders, and that's how there's, and they're still in power. The Espírito Santo administrator was actually in the ministry council where the Troika agreement was finally settled. So this is how strong these people are. I mean, and obviously not even in Portugal that is supposed to happen. Not even in a banana republic like Portugal you're supposed to have a big banker sitting with the ministers deciding an agreement that will last 3 years and will basically restrain the sovereignty of the country. But that's the country where that kind of thing happens, and it's all normal. They own a lot of newspapers, they condition the television through the publicity, and so that country is in the pocket of, again, the guys who owned the country before, some newcomers, and some international interests, obviously.
on the situation right now of the social movements in Portugal. And yeah, I read a text, it was on that page, .com or something, I don't know, Editions Antipaticas, something like that. And they had a rather optimistic diagnosis, I think. It was like they described the process of the social movements of the last 3 years as a process of like gaining experience and becoming stronger and more radical. And I would be interested in how you see the situation right now. And
you live there.
I'm a member of the collective who wrote that.
You are part of the problem.
Yeah, I'm part of the problem. I'm definitely not part of the solution. So the text was originally written in Portuguese and for a Portuguese audience, and so in the public, in the sense that it was this self-reflection of the movement. We never pose ourselves as this vanguard group that comes and says, everyone, this is what you should do. It was more, what we tried to do was the contributing to a process of discussion of what had happened in the last years that would help us. So, and expecting other people to come forward and say, you're totally wrong, or we agree with you on that, not on that. So a discussion. And that, it was almost finished in November 2012. Then a big riot occurred, so we had to write about it. And then there was a demonstration called, so we said, okay, let's just wait for this demonstration. And so eventually it was finished in March 2013. Although in LibCom it says the last 3 years, it's actually, so it only came out this year, so with the year gap. And in that year, a lot of things didn't happen. And so that's relevant to understanding the situation there. How the text ends is, there was a big demonstration in March the 2nd, 2013, so a year and a half, or a year and some months ago, where there was like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So I was in the end, but when I looked back, I couldn't see the end of the demonstration. And when I got to the square where it was supposed to happen, it had already finished. In the sense that there were no lights, the stage had been shut down, and people had just scattered. I think what happened mostly in Portugal is that after a long time, so when the first anti-austerity movement started coming up, all the left organizations started disputing it and trying to beat the direction of it. And after some months and a lot of events which are described in that text, they just couldn't do it. And after a while, they were not allowed to do it at all. So there was no stage in the end of a demonstration, in the sense that when a demonstration arrived at somewhere, there would start clashes immediately. Well, not immediately, but after half an hour. But there was no space for a direction or, you know, a spokesperson, somebody to come and say, okay, this demonstration was about this, we're here to show them this and that, which is the classical demonstration. For a while there was no conditions for that kind of direction of the movement to come up. And during the fall of 2012, that was the main dispute, whether or not we would allow that direction to come forward. And after November 14th was a general strike. It ended with a lot of things burning, a lot of clashes with the police, a lot of people arrested. I think the most radical and militant, you know, people within the movement just got scared. And we lost the initiative then. I really can't go very far because I decided to go to Barcelona to the general strike that happened on that day, so I wasn't there. So then afterwards I wasn't there to say, okay, let's just take the initiative again. People were really scared of what was going to happen. In the newspapers, it was constantly announced that the police was about to crash in people's houses to arrest the people responsible for that. And I think we lost the initiative there, sadly. And that demonstration in March the 2nd had thousands and thousands of people, but in the end there was a stage and a speech and people who actually said, okay, this is over now, you can go home. And so this apparatus, dispositive, I don't know how you say it in English, or the Foucault thing, dispositive, device, But this device in which there's people who call the demonstration, who tell in advance what the demonstration is about, will go to the press, say what it's about, and during the demonstration guarantee that it goes on smoothly, which is legally, and then in the end make a speech and tell you what it's about and then tell you it's over. That device was blocked for a year and a half or 2 years, I don't know, and then it came back and we allow it to be reinstored. And after that, we lost the initiative. After that, a lot of things happened still. There was a general strike in June of last year, in which we did some very interesting actions and pickets, a lot less attention, a lot less media coverage, obviously. That ended with like 450 people marching to block the bridge over the river. They were kind of surrounded, arrested, whatnot, which made the trade unions to call for a march over the bridge, which the government illegalized. And the trade, and at that moment, there was another crucial moment because we wanted it to happen in order to make it even more radical and go on and block the port of Lisbon, the harbor. And at the last minute, the trade unions backed out, so the Communist Party again. They're always in this story, basically, because they controlled the unions in Portugal. And what happened was the trade unions controlled by the Communist Party backed out. The trade union of the dock workers, who were a very radicalized sector during the last years, also backed out from the port blockade. And what ended up was like some hundreds of people marching into the port and facing a huge police block and back, basically. And I think mostly that we let the left-wing parties, which were never in government in the last years, so they're considered to be anti-power and anti-system because they're not in the government. But what they do basically is that the government controls us everywhere and they control us when we're trying to fight the government control. So they control the streets. And for some years they lost that control because the streets were flooded by thousands of people who just made their own rules. And after the first real clashes with the police, that wave started retreating, and then in this process of a year long, they gained the momentum and they gained the initiative. It's not over yet. I think the best is yet to come. But it is true that we're losing, so because basically what you have now is the device, the dispositif that was created after 25th November. We're still living that, so when I wrote that text, Neverwinter has been so long, it's basically we're still living that time in which the street is no longer this unrestful, uncontrollable social force, but is actually part of a bigger strategy by the left-wing parties to uphold, to enhance and enlarge their influence in the institutions. And what you have now is the Communist Party and the left bloc, to a lesser degree, trying to channel the discontent of the streets to the elections. And up until now, they've been quite successful. The Communist Party just had 12.5% in the last elections, the European election, which is a very good result from their point of view. Yeah, but well, go with all that. Yeah, it is. So more than half the people didn't vote. So this libertarian spirit of which George was speaking of, I think it's still important. The problem is that between its passivity and its activity, there are huge gaps here, right? Time gaps. So our challenge here is to make the passivity moment be substituted for more very active moments. But there's no tradition in Portugal of big riots and confronting the police as there is in Germany, for instance, or in Spain, for that matter. So that kind of habit of confronting the police, it's not as strong there. What we wanted to point out in that text and that analysis was how it was kind of starting to emerge. So the goal was make Portugal Greece. If they want to make Portugal Greece, we'll make Portugal Greece. This was the idea in the streets. But as you can see also in Greece, things are not as simple as leading a lot of things in fire. It's much more complex than that. So although I think we've been defeated, but it's not over yet.
You already
already said that Communist Party was under attack. It was especially in the north of the country. Mm-hmm. And my
75.
Yeah. And my question is, in my opinion, I'm not that expert that you brought up. The question was, the country was divided. That in the north, the society was more Catholic, was more. You had small landowners, something like this. And my question is about, did the revolution never reach the north of the country or during the break, if the MFDR failed to reach the people there, if they made any mistakes to win the people in the north for revolution, or it was perhaps it was impossible because they were too traditional.
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's all you said. It's true, but it's not enough to understand what happened. First of all, the north is there are north and north. I mean, there is a very industrialized, and there was a very strong industrialized part of the north of Portugal. All the zone on the coast and from Porto towards Galicia, and in that area, at that time, the exception for the big city of Porto, but the rest of these industrial zones, the CP was not very strong, the Communist Party. But that was for historical reasons, I think. What is interesting is that today, that's one of the strong basis of the Communist Party in this area, this north industrialized small factories, textiles, and places like that. They had improved their implantation in that zone, but I think it's more a connection with the. It's not so much the north and south. It's a connection with the form of landowners. I mean, in the south, not the real south, but just Alentejo, the part between Lisbon and the real south, the land ownership was latifundio, and so there was for years and years and centuries a tradition of struggle there, and the people saw themselves not as peasants but as work peasants or as working people working in the land, but not as landowners. And also there was the fact that in the north there was a stronger influence of the church, who is a very strong political force in Portugal at that time. It was a party we didn't talk about, but a very strong party. And they had a role to control that zone in a very well done way, and they play a role against all the revolutionary measures or projects or so forth. And it's also true that the movement was basically strong in the urban areas and in these areas where there was the land workers. So the people in these backwards areas with small ownership, very, very poor, controlled by the church, it was difficult to reach them. And that was not so much, I don't think that didn't play a very strong role in the Portuguese Revolution. If there was a movement, if the movement itself has been developed in an autonomous and dependent way, and the new forms of production and distribution have been developed, I think these areas will be connected more easily with the movement, but they were very isolated, and the only connection these areas had with the outside was through immigration. That was another aspect that played a role in this movement, because the majority of the immigration, especially in France, Belgium, and Switzerland, but especially in France at that time, they came from those areas, and they were quite conservative, even if they were workers in France, and they saw the Polish Revolution in a very conservative way, and they were scared, because they were scared to lose the money they had put in this village, build their houses and all that, and they saw, they accept the propaganda of the church and of the right, saying that the revolution was going to take their beans and beings and all that. But I mean, all these things are just facts. I personally don't think these areas played a very strong role in the revolution, and I think that they played a role when things went down. But when people were in movement, the social movement was having a development, these zones didn't play a very strong role. The army and the left, the traditional left in the army, Communist Party and some Maoist groups, they tried to do what they call dynamization of these areas. They send to this village a doctor or a nurse, try to improve the living conditions of people and make some help them to learn how to read and to write. I mean, it was very nice, but I mean, didn't really came from the people themselves, this thing. I mean, so it was like new doctors coming from the city, helping us, it's okay, it's nice, but in fact they were making a confrontation with the church and with the local cacique, and all these people who had a role there. So I don't know, I don't think it was a very important thing. I think that the immigration play a more strong role in the conservative turn, and also the people who came from the colonies, who were based mostly in the urban areas, and they also play a role in this turn against this sort of phobia, anti-communist phobia. But for me, at that moment, the movement was already, I think the movement was already in the downturn. I think the real turn in the movement was inside of the enterprises, inside of the occupied houses, and inside of the land occupied. And when inside of these places, people start to get disengaged, start to get tired, start to withdraw from the political fight between all the political groups, that's when the turn came for me. So the rest is just an accumulation of small factors that came through that. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
I agree with part of it. So I think there's two elements that I think are important here. Adding to what George said, the first is this demobilization of people in the factories and the enterprises regarding the control over their elected, you know, representatives and whatnot, that there was a withdrawal, and that explains, I didn't mention it before, I just spoke about the state, how the state played the very good cards in that, but also this kind of competition praxis over by the far-left groups also had a major impact, mm-hmm. because basically every far-left group had its workers' committees, its tenants' committees, its soldiers' organization. So it's very common to hear far-left people in Portugal say, what we lacked in the revolution was a direction. And I think there were too many. There were like 15, all self-appointed, obviously, all, you know, balkanized, all, I control this, you control that, and all that, and all always fighting amongst themselves and all fighting against the Communist Party. So this is the major trend. And after a while, people in, you know, in the factory are like, okay, I've already gotten my wage enhancement, fascism is probably not coming back, and I'm sick and tired of these guys. So I'm withdrawing to my private life and whatnot. So that was a major element, although it's very nuanced. Not everybody did that. Thousands of people didn't do that. So in the fall of 75, the movement was still very strong, and that's why a velvet counter-revolution was needed. Because otherwise, a civil war would have been a very risky card for the Portuguese ruling class to play. But also,
And the Spanish one.
So, and I think this explanation of the national borders, this also answers some of the questions you've made. I think a revolution in Portugal would have been impossible. But Portugal, as the start of a European revolution, would have been very possible, especially in southern Europe. I don't want to... But, you know, Spain was... Franco was about to die... the society was in a turmoil. Italy was the long May 68. France was France, and so it's a scenario. It's kind of virtual history. But if it had worked, it would not have been Portuguese socialism. It would have probably been the beginning of European revolution, with all that it implies. So a huge civil war, conflict, the Cold War. And this is the complexity, because it's the years of May 68 and the Cold Civil War, the Cold War, all overlapping and, you know, articulating and all that. But also about the church, there was one social conflict that actually had big implications with the church, which was the church radio, Radio Renascença. It was occupied by the workers, and they self-managed it for several months. So the bishops were all like, we want our radio back. We want our radio. No, really, we want our radio back. There were big demonstrations against the workers' committee. The Communist Party wasn't involved, but it was the far left, or, you know, the workers. But the far left was more backing it. But in the north, it was seen as the communists are taking over the church's radio. And that's how the church presented it. So people would go to mass, would hear the priest say the communists are taking over everything, including our radio, and people would leave mass and go and burn the Communist Party headquarters or some far-left organizations where they were, or the trade unions. This was very strong in the north. The only places in the north where it didn't happen was Viana do Castelo, where there was a big shipyard, so big working-class numbers, and in Vila Real, where there was a left-wing regiment of infantry, where it didn't allow it either. Otherwise, in the north, all the communist parties, big headquarters, big or not so big, all burned, people died, bombs were exploded, and so forth. And the Radio Renascença conflict was very polarizing. It ended up by the government ordering it to be restored to the church. The workers just occupied it and said, we won't come out. The military said, we won't take them out. And so what the government did was send the parachuting, the parachutes, and said, okay, we have a secret mission for you. They didn't tell them what it was. They sent them, and they put bombs on the transmitters. And that actually triggered the coup d'etat of 25th of November, because then the parachutes revolted against the government because they had been misled and so forth. But that radio renaissance conflict was a major element in terms of the church openly going against the regime, which was the Communist Party upper hand in provisional governments. This is all very complicated when you go to details. And in these campaigns, some of them went better than the others, these dynamization campaigns.
Yes.
So the first ones were all about giving toilets to people, doctors to people, building, bringing electricity, building roads. And that was kind of popular in the late 74. After that, the far left officers in the army said, no, that's not enough. Let's teach them politics. And that's when things really went sour. Because they had this habit of Africa, of the political, social campaigns, getting the population to us. And that's what they tried to do in, you know, rural peasant Portugal. And that was really unpopular. They were chased out of some villages several times.
They treat them like blacks. They didn't.
Yeah, that was also, there was a racist thing to it, right? They're treating us like they treated the Africans. So this is a very complex moment there. And I honestly, I probably Jorge doesn't agree with me, but I think Portuguese peasants from northern Portugal, they're, you know, revolution-proof. They're very conservative people. I worked with some of them in southern France picking fruit, and I don't want to generalize. Obviously, there's all kinds of people, but there's this structural conservatism that is just very strong, in the sense that there were 50 of us sharing quarters. Each one had its broom, its pan, its forks, its knives. Each one had its own thing, and nobody shared. That was like communism, you know? You want to share a broom? That's communism. And I really do think that until today, there's two countries there. It's not only about North and South, but it's a little bit about North and South. And it's the property structure. So big property, wage labor, small property, each one has its own thing. Nobody wants to share. And this.
So, it's like, for example, makes So I think all the time there's kind of idea here, these Stalinists, this Communist Party of the European Social Democracy killed our wonderful, beautiful libertarian revolution. And not to argue in a psychoanalytical way, which might mean to say, we are lucky enough that they killed our revolution, because if we had really been forced to be responsible for the further course of this revolution and what is might have what we might have been faced with, luckily enough we haven't. So in a way, but this is not what I mean. We know since 1914 or 18 that the counter revolution will face us under red flags. So, one point for me, or what I really like to ask is these problems you have.
Well, I think I understand what you mean, and in a way I agree with you. I don't think the Portuguese revolution, to talk about this special event, was defeated by the Stalinists. I think it was defeated by itself. I think it was defeated by the fact that it was not able to develop the capacity that has been created in the beginning to develop it to a level and to spread it to a point in which the political forces will be obliged to function in connection with that, but not directing it. Okay? So I think in a social movement, there are the political groups are part of a social movement, but I tend to underline what the people really does themselves more than what the groups do themselves. And that was what I think it was important in the Portuguese Revolution, and that goes back to the last question that Christopher had put in the presentation. What is modern still today in this revolution? I think there are two things modern. One is the fact that it was a movement that was able, besides the fact that it was a society full of groups, political groups, directions, it was extremely politicized in that sense. But besides that, there was a movement that was able to produce and create organizations, relations amongst themselves, forms. Experience of productions, trying to put things together. They didn't have enough time, and maybe they didn't have enough energy of strengthness to do it. And in this process, a lot of people from the political groups participate. Even a lot of communists from the Communist Party participate in autonomous struggles in Portugal at that time, even if after they were having problems with the direction of the party and so forth. But there was a moment, and that's true in every social movement, I think. There is a moment where, or a long moment, we hope it's the longer it can be, where people, even part of political groups, can integrate and participate in something that it's bigger than themselves and bigger than their groups. And that's, I think, a modern aspect of the Portuguese Revolution. The second modern aspect, and that we go back to the political groups, is the fact that in any social movement nowadays, in modern societies, I think that the first counter-revolution aspect is any possibility that the movement is taken by a political group. That's the beginning of the end. And that's also very modern in the Portuguese Revolution. But I agree with you that it's not a question of... I didn't answer the question about the libertarians, but I'm going to answer. But it's not the question of the role of the Communist Party, who is to be criticized as being the bad guy. And they were present, they were very strong, but they ran after the movement for a long time. And that was an important moment. After, it became other thing. Concerning the libertarian groups, is the same thing. I see them as I can see the Communist Party. It's the same thing. If it is a group who wants to impose his ideas on a movement, they play more or less the same role. In Portugal, they were very, very weak. There is, as maybe you may know, in the social history of Portugal, a very big importance of the anarcho-syndicalism and revolutionary unionism till the 20s. And it's from that tradition that the Communist Party actually was created, which is quite original in Europe. It's one of the cases, I think the only one in Europe that I know, where the Communist Party was created by anarchists directly. So that tradition is still very strong in the Portuguese society, but very, very offset. People don't know anything about that. Some people know, but very little people. And at that time, these groups didn't exist at all. They have been destroyed by the fascism. They have been replaced by the Communist Party. It's a complicated story. We are not going to develop that here. But when the revolution started, when these autonomous movements started, there were libertarian tendencies who appeared inside of the movement who saw themselves as such without having the reference of the past. They didn't know that there was an anarchist movement. Many of them didn't know anything about that, but they assumed the fact they were apartidaire, they were anti-authoritarian, they were against a group or a party directing the revolution. So in a way, it was these tendencies who were the libertarian movement in Portugal, not groups. I get what I want to say. It was not a formal libertarian movement, but the fact that inside of the movement itself, there was a tendency who was pushing for things that we can call from the outside libertarians. And of course there are some groups who connect with that and play the role, especially a magazine called Combat, which has produced not a daily paper, but I think it was a monthly paper for a long period of time after it became, slowly it became a more scared periodicity. But this magazine was created by people who came from the Maoism and others who came from immigration and others who came from anarchist tendencies, and their idea was to give a space in the magazine to the workers themselves. So they had an editorial once in a while, but most of the paper was full of interventions of people who were fighting in their factories or their occupying their land or occupying houses or things like that. And this paper had quite an influence in that tendency that I call libertarian inside of the movement itself. And there were a small attempt to create an union connect with the left tendency of the church, so that not everything is bad in the church, which was called Basis. And they also had some people in the factories, and they produced also a paper. Another magazine also in Porto called First May, which was has also that perspective of giving, helping people to organize themselves and giving them the word that they could speak for themselves. So all these things exist, but they were a minority, of course. But it's something that was mixed in all over but for instance, these tendencies were at that time more important than, for instance, I'm just taking a comparison, than the Trotskyites, who didn't almost exist in the Portuguese society at that time. But the Maoists were the main current, and they were very authoritarian, so it's...
I hope you didn't get me wrong, so I didn't want to speak in favor of Marxism.
No. But
so my question was, were there tendencies to build up a kind of class of conscience, to face realistic what might happen, what we are confronted with, and how to go on? So this was my point. So, and to
I think the word, key word here is ambiguity, because you had 48 years of fascism and whatnot. So to have an underground organization, it's not easy to do it in a libertarian way, right? You have to be compartmentation, trust in the people who you hardly know. So it's very easy to develop authoritarian relationships. Even anarchist groups underground in Spain, for instance, which they kept very anarcho-Bolsheviks. That's how most people who participated in it call it right now. And so that obviously created the space for these Maoist groups, very authoritarian, compartmented, discipline, you know, Bolshevik discipline, that sort of imaginarium, to have a stronger role comparatively than in the rest of democratic Europe. So you had a lot of Maoists in France, but, I mean, were they key elements of a labor struggle? Hardly ever. But in Portugal, they were. And some libertarian topics were developed within or by these groups, just as like these leftist Catholics were against the church, although, right? But like MESH, the movement of socialist left, which was very inspired in the Chilean MIR, and also in Lotta Continua in Italy, and the PSUP and PSU in France and whatnot, they were kind of libertarian but kind of Leninists. And so this ambiguity was, you know, entangled in the movement. And so it's not always easy to solve these ambiguities after such a long period where there's censorship. Not every radical literature circulates. It's funny, though, that the Society of Spectacle was edited in 72 or 3 in Portugal, even before 25th of April. I think the censors looked at it and said, yeah, just let it through, nobody will read it. But there were some efforts, material efforts, not to escape to your question, just to precise, these campaigns in the north were not the Maoist groups or the Communist Party by itself. It was the military, formally, so the state, but under the influence of the Communist Party and the Maoists. And so some groups organized and some, like, some workers' committees and, like, the students of the medical school organized in order to provide medical care in, you know, poor neighborhoods. Some neighborhood committees organized to have them come. So these structures actually developed. What was always absent was an overall perspective how to develop this strategically to gain space from the state. There was always an ambiguous relationship with the state. And when the state clearly went one way and rebuilt itself, that ambiguity was solved against us. I think that's kind of how I would explain it mostly. But ambiguity is the word. And for a long time it lasted, and then it was solved in one direction.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.